Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, what else? The Iditarod. I'm your host, Josh Edge. This year, Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio and NOM are teaming up to try something new. We're going to be doing one of these podcasts each week ahead of the last great race. Then we'll switch over to doing a daily podcast once the race starts. The idea is you can wake up, brush your teeth, make your coffee, and get caught up on everything that's happened in the last few hours on the trail. I don't know how you're listening to this right now, but the best thing to do is subscribe to this podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcatcher app you're using. That will ensure that you get the episodes delivered right to your phone as soon as they're done. Today, I'm joined by Molly Redig from KUEC in Fairbanks.
Hi there.
And I have Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, who will be one of our reporters out on the trail for this year's Iditarod.
Hey, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. So let's take a look at the other 1,000-mile sled dog race, the Yukon Quest. The winner arrived in Fairbanks around noon on Tuesday, and I think there's more mushers approaching the finish line right now as we speak. Molly, you were on the trail covering the race for KUAC. Can you tell us a bit about what happened?
Sure. So just got back to Fairbanks yesterday. We started in Whitehorse two Saturdays ago, and it's been pretty nonstop since then. It was kind of perfect running conditions in Whitehorse, cold and clear. By the time they got to the midway point in Dawson, the temperature was dropping, but the trail was super fast, and everybody was saying it was the best trail that they'd seen. So you were seeing really fast run times into Dawson. And then the temperature kind of bottomed out, and just as mushers were getting on the Yukon River, we were seeing 40 below, 50 below, and the pace got a lot more sluggish, and things got interesting. So Matt Hall won. It was really exciting. It was his fourth year running, and he's just kind of gradually been climbing up in the standings, but he won by 7 hours, beating three other Quest champion, so that was pretty remarkable.
And Matt Hall's only 25 years old, right? Can you tell me a little bit more about him and his background, where he comes from?
Matt's 25, so that makes him the second youngest winner after Dallas Stevie was 24 when he won a few years ago. But Matt started mushing when he was about four, so that sort of gives him an advantage over some other mushers, if you think about it. He grew up on a homestead 6 miles downriver from Eagle. His dad was a bush pilot, and they moved out there maybe 30 years ago to trap, and they started doing dog tours. And so Matt grew up running the trap line. His parents would set him up on a team in between their teams, and they'd run through the jumble ice, through the woods. So he has a lot of experience with rough ice and overflow and tight, narrow trees. And I think it's just sort of second nature for him.
Did Matt have a chance of winning this race, or did he just kind of come out of the woodwork as a total dark horse who emerged as events unfolded?
He wasn't a dark horse. He finished third 3 years ago and then fourth last year. So he was definitely a contender. But up until he got to Eagle, I don't think anybody thought that he could take first. And so, yeah, he's one of these younger mushers that's had really good seasons the last couple years. He won the Copper Basin 300 last year, so he's definitely been a threat and a rising star. But for the past few years, the Quest has really been dominated by the three amigos, Alan Moore, Brent Sass, and Hugh Neff. And so Matt is a bit of a new name in the mix.
Yeah, and I'd actually like to talk a little bit about Alan Moore. It seemed like in the early stages of the race, he and Matt Hall were playing a little bit of a cat and mouse game. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because they live in the same neighborhood and run on the same trails and see each other almost daily when they're training in Two Rivers outside Fairbanks. And Matt Hall and Alan Moore were running really close into Dawson, and Matt decided he wanted to stop in camp, and then he saw Alan sailing by, and Alan is sort of known for aggressive poling, so he was just ski poling away and flew past Matt, and then Matt got sort of flustered because he didn't want to lose the top three, and so he had just been taking booties off his dogs. He put the booties back on, got back on the trail, and Alan had just parked a couple miles ahead of him to rest. And then Matt, he saw Matt flying by, and Matt said, "Hey, I thought you were on your way to Dawson." And Alan said, "No, I'll see you there." So once Matt was in front, Alan sort of used that energy to chase Matt's team and pull his dogs into Dawson. And they were both laughing about it when they got to the Dawson checkpoint that night. A little bit of gamesmanship that you always see along the trail in the Yukon Quest.
So with Alan Moore and Matt Hall neck and neck there playing some mind games with each other, where did things stand once racers got to the midway point in Dawson?
Well, from Pelly Crossing, Brent Sass sort of took off and did some long runs into Dawson. So he came into Dawson, which is the halfway point, with a 4-hour lead over Hugh Neff. And he looked really strong. The dogs looked awesome and they were eating really well. And he was, you know, really tired, but really excited to be over the first summit. And when I talked to Brent in Dawson, he was just really focused on running strong and steady. So it was pretty surprising to see that he ran into some trouble outside of Central.
Can you run us through that? He eventually scratched. What happened?
So I guess around 1 PM, Brent Sass pushed his emergency beacon and the Quest got a team together to go check on him. He was about 12 miles outside of Central at that point. And when they got there, he had two dogs in his sled bag. And we learned from a follow-up comment by Brent that one of his dogs, Healy, had collapsed mid-stride out of the blue. So we put him in the bag and he was going to really point it into Central to try to get vet care. And then 20 minutes later, his second dog, Caputo, also dropped in the same fashion. And so he was really concerned, pushed the button. And at that point, he figured he was out of the race based on the rules. And when he eventually met with a race judge a little bit later, the race judge offered him the option of continuing because it had been deemed an emergency. And so he encouraged him to run into Central and just take a rest and think about it. But at that point, Brent was really shaken up, and he said that his race was over pretty adamantly. So we never saw Brent come into Central. He ran his dogs over to the Circle Hot Springs Airport and got picked up there, and that was the end of the race. And we know that the dogs are okay, which is really good news. I think he was just extremely rattled by the suddenness of his dogs dropping like that.
Molly, do we know why Quest officials were willing to let Brent continue with his run? Like, do we know why they gave him that option? And am I right in thinking that Brent turned it down because he was just too rattled to continue?
So this comes down to Rule 13, and I was speaking with one of the judges about this because it happened last year, too, in different circumstances. If you push the button because your dogs need attention, there is the possibility of continuing your race. And I think they allow that flexibility because they don't want to discourage people from pushing the button if their dogs need help, as opposed to just waiting and running into a checkpoint, which would take longer. But on the flip side, they also don't want people to use that as a fallback or a safety net. So they decide whether or not to disqualify you based on once they look at the dogs and deem whether it was an emergency or not. At that point, they will either scratch you and withdraw you from the race or give you the option to continue.
So once Brent Sass opted to scratch, that left Matt with a pretty substantial lead. But as we've seen from numerous Iditarods and Yukon Quests, a substantial lead toward the end of the race does not guarantee a win. Were there any hiccups in the last few legs of Matt's race?
Everybody was saying Matt was on a magic carpet ride because basically from the time he got to Eagle until the time he crossed the finish line in Fairbanks, he didn't have much go wrong. Birch Creek was a slog, and it was 50 below, and there was no glide. And so he took an extra rest on his way to Central. And then in Central is where he learned that Brenton had dropped out. He knew he was 6 or 7 hours ahead of the next musher. And so he went back to bed and just took his time. And then I think he really just focused on rest. Matt's big concern was getting past his kennel in Two Rivers, because apparently after running 900 miles, when dogs get on their home trails, they're thinking about their dog houses more than the finish line sometimes. And so he was worried that there might be a big slowdown going past his house in Two Rivers. But he said he gave them one command and they went on by, and they knew they were headed to the finish. And it was Matt's first time going in this direction, so I think there was a lot of uncertainty of not just crossing Eagle Summit, but making sure he could glide past his kennel in Two Rivers.
So Matt claimed his first title in the Yukon Quest. Can you just quickly round out the rest of, say, the top five for us?
Matt came in at lunchtime on Tuesday, and then Hugh Neff showed up at dinner time on Tuesday, about 7 hours behind Matt. Alan Moore came in at around 10 o'clock last night, and then Paige Drobny came in sometime in the middle of the night, which is amazing for her. She's run the Quest twice before and finished 14th both times. And then Ed Hopkins from Yukon came in fifth.
Is that 7 hour lead between Matt Hall and Hugh Neff a pretty substantial difference between those top contenders, or is that pretty standard?
I would say it's big. Like Matt was saying at the finish, he hadn't expected to be slingshotted ahead like that, because he was just inching his way, you know, further and further toward the top the last few years. Last year, Hugh Neff beat Brent Sass by an hour and a half. And I know a few years ago, the last time that Hugh Neff had won, he beat Alan Moore by 26 seconds coming into Whitehorse. And so sometimes there are nail-biter finishes. This was not one of them. This was a very kind of comfortable lead, basically because Matt did this huge, risky run right in the middle of it and gave himself a really big advantage, and it paid off, and his dogs didn't slow down, and nobody else except for Brent was anywhere near him.
Switching gears just a bit, you've covered this race twice. What's it like doing it in reverse and going from Whitehorse to Fairbanks instead of Fairbanks to Whitehorse?
Well, it's really nice to finish in Fairbanks, where I live, and just to be downtown by the Chena River at the finish chute. It's a very welcome home feeling for the mushers as well as for me. The race is entirely different. The whole time I was sort of turned around and disoriented, because the dynamics and the emotion at each checkpoint is just really different. Like last year at Braeburn, it was Hugh Neff coming in 2 hours ahead of everybody and, you know, pretty much set on winning the race at that point. And it was 35 degrees going into Whitehorse. There wasn't much snow. He only had 100 miles to the finish. And then this year at Braeburn, we barely saw the mushers because the leaders had already, you know, blown through in the first day. And so that part is different. And then it also, if you look at the race profile, you can see it's much harder this year with Eagle Summit at the end. Eagle Summit is really the reckoning of this race, where a lot of teams turn around or quit or get stuck. And to have that at the end of the race when the dogs have 800 miles on their legs rather than fresh legs is a big game changer. Also doing Eagle Summit in this direction is where you have the kind of elevator chute type ascent, where you have to basically drag your sled and kind of lean into the hill and crawl uphill. And it's pretty hard for dogs to pull a sled up that. So I think there's a bit more dread of that ascent going in this direction. The center of the race is sort of the same vibe. Like once you get to Dawson City, there's just this great party atmosphere, and you're halfway done and you're in this cool Klondike town. But I would say the beginning and the end are upside down.
What's it like for you getting between the checkpoints? I mean, how are you getting around, and how are you contending with some of those more rugged elements like 50 below temps?
Yeah, it's interesting, because sometimes you wish you were on a dog sled and just doing one continuous travel on a marked route. It's a lot more complicated when you're following the race as a reporter or a handler or as official. You're doing a combination of riding in vans, hitching rides on the Klondike Highway, and flying in bush planes to the remote checkpoints on the Yukon, and then, you know, sometimes just running down the trail to try to get your picture or soundbite. So it's really fun. It's very, very adventurous for me following the race. Sometimes I feel a little left out just seeing mushers at the checkpoints because they've come in from this great adventure. They've been on the Yukon River for 160 miles or they've just crossed a summit and they're describing the scenery and the mountain peaks that were like popping up above the clouds. And it's kind of a tease because you're just waiting for them and asking them questions. So, you know, after 2 weeks of covering other people's winter adventures, I'm really ready to go have my own. But that said, it's so cool to be able to follow along 1,000 miles. I've been talking to these mushers and checking out their dogs for the last 12 days, and you really get to see the progression and the highs and lows and kind of see inside the race and what it must feel like to try to do this type of challenge.
What did you eat?
The checkpoint food was surprisingly good. I think I only had to eat one Mountain House and probably like 4 pounds of Gorp.
Well, thanks so much for that recap of the Yukon Quest, Molly.
You're welcome.
Now, switching gears to the Iditarod, we had some big news last week about a change in the race route. Zach, what do we know?
Well, race officials held a press conference last Friday after the board of directors met. And, you know, they held a closed-door session to evaluate whether it was worth switching the start of the race up to Fairbanks, as they did in 2015 and for the first time in 2003. And the reason they did that, the reason this was a concern, was there was a really bare stretch of trail around the Dalzell Gorge. And this is the same patch of really rough, rugged technical terrain that had given mushers huge problems in the 2014 race. And the Iditarod Trail Committee came under a lot of criticism for letting mushers go forward with that. It led to a lot of injuries, a lot of broken equipment. And so when they were aware that there were problems with that section of the trail, you know, they met, they took trail reports into consideration, and they ultimately decided to reroute the race, starting it in Fairbanks and, you know, continuing from there.
So this is the second time in a row the southern route has been skipped over, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So with the race starting in Fairbanks then, what does the trail look like? What's going to be different for mushers, you know, weather? I mean, it's going to be a dramatically different race.
Well, yes and no. It's dramatically different on the first half, and actually it resembles, you know, the Yukon Quest a lot more closely. Long stretches of interior weather, which, you know, at least 2 years ago meant a lot of really deep cold early in the race, which changes people's strategy. So for that first section, it's, you know, river miles closer to the quest, and then it picks up like a normal year on the northern route. So mushers will come into Ruby, they'll go to Galena, and then to make up some extra space, they sort of veer north to Hooslea and then come down and meet at Kayakuk. And from there, they head to Caltag, and it resumes the consistent, you know, no matter which route you're taking, the coast is always the same. So from Caltag onward, completely normal from there.
So what about these communities along that southern route that are going to be skipped over again? What's the impact for them?
That's a good question. And, you know, I don't have all the answers on that. There was some really good reporting by Tegan Hanlon, who covers the Iditarod for the Alaska Dispatch News. And, you know, she talked to lodge owners on the early part of the route. Some of them say they're going to lose up to $60,000 in business. Other lodge owners are quoted as saying, you know, it's in the 20s, 30s of thousands of dollars that they're probably going to miss. You know, I haven't seen estimates for those communities like Anvik and Shagaluk and Grayling that are specific to the southern route. And, you know, it's only every 2 years that mushers are routed through there. And with mushers come, you know, maybe handlers and Iditarod staff, reporters like me who are maybe paying for bed and breakfasts. So there's some capital that's definitely lost, and I haven't seen estimates for that. And then, you know, I think also it's fair to say there's the loss of the tradition of people coming through and checkpoints being set up and those communities being really part of this massive statewide event. You know, I imagine some of the logistics after 4 or 6 years begin to deteriorate and some of the continuity. This being the second time in a row that the southern route's been bypassed for a Fairbanks start, I think that's going to matter.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be a big impact for all those communities. Now let's take a look at an often overlooked or even unknown aspect of the competitive mushing world, the handlers. They're essentially an army of low-paid, semi-skilled labor that does a lot of the heavy lifting around the kennels of a lot of the world's top mushers. Zach, you were up in the interior a couple weeks ago and had a chance to catch up with a couple of the handlers. And I'd like to listen to a piece that you put together that dives into this a little bit.
Inside a cold, dim room, Tara Cicatello stirs a bucket of frothy brown liquid.
I am making dog food.
It's a mix of kibble and frozen meat that's been thawed into a soupy kind of gruel. Cicatello grabs a heavy bucket in each one of her hands, trundles out to the dog yard, and starts slopping food into bowls.
Hey, buddy. Here's some supper.
Cicatello is in charge of feeding 25 dogs twice a day. After they eat, she retraces her steps, scooping away piles of poop.
Literally, I just take the sled in one hand, the shovel in the other, and I just knock it out.
The whole routine takes about an hour. Most of the time, it's in the dark, under a headlamp, and there are no days off, even when it's 50 below. This is the less glamorous side of dog mushing. Cicatello is a handler for a relatively new musher, Kristen Bacon, who finished her first Iditarod last year. This season, Bacon's training out of champion musher Jeff King's Husky Homestead, north of Cantwell. Cicatello stays in a small apartment on the property and gets a modest monthly stipend. In exchange, she does everything from feedings to practice runs to mushing the dogs in mid-distance races, one of which the two women are getting ready for now. Bacon is sitting on the floor, plotting where they'll rest.
Remember that you need to think about Tal Vista to Deshka Landing is 75 miles, and whether you really want to run a 75-mile run or you're going to have a little nap.
These logistics are complex, sort of like planning a multi-day camping trip spread out over 200 miles, but also with a pack of animals attached by ropes. They're assembling drop bags with all the supplies they'll need, from food to overstuffed Ziplocs full of dog booties, color-coordinated to match each animal's paw size.
They'd be red, Yama, orange, Skeeter red.
This is where good help makes a huge difference. Bacon needs a lot from her handler, particularly because she's not a professional musher and still has to work a job to pay her bills. She's a physical therapist for kids and regularly travels to small communities far away from her kennel. And when she's gone, she needs Cicatello not just to dog sit, but to put miles on her team for serious races.
I either need to pay to have really good help here with my dogs and trust that whoever's here taking care of them and feeding them is doing an appropriate job so that I can go work.
For Hamslow, the economic logic is less conventional. The arrangement falls somewhere between an apprenticeship and indentured servitude. Handlers are subject to the same state labor laws and minimum wage standards as other employees, but a director with the Department of Labor says hardly any claims are reported to the state about labor abuse in the mushing industry. And for Cicatello, the grit itself is a selling point.
I love adventure, and I love going out and doing things, and so to me, just like sitting in office all day was not fulfilling.
Cicatello graduated a few years ago with an English degree from a college in upstate New York, where she grew up. She got her start mushing when she lived in Nome, where, full disclosure, we were briefly roommates and stayed in touch. Handling dogs is a bit of a career gamble for her, if she ever decides to leave the mushing world.
I wish I could tell you I had, like, long-term life plan plans, but I'm really bad at making those. So far, I've been living my life season to season.
In some ways, mushing is highly specialized labor. But Cicatello doesn't feel like she's cutting herself off from other work opportunities. She's just 25 years old and has had enough odd and seasonal jobs that she's not really worried about finding other work if she needs to. And you don't get into mushing to make money. That's something I heard from other handlers, too, including Sean Underwood, who moved up from Georgia to commercial fish and stuck around Alaska when he got the chance to handle for Jeff King.
I graduated with a degree in economics, minored in Spanish, and now I'm just running a 12-dog team, so I don't know where the supply and demand chart for economics comes into play there.
Underwood is excited but a little nervous as he gets ready to run the same race as Cicatello. Except for him, this is his first time ever competing on a sled. He never expected to be in this position. Back in Atlanta, he was a hotel valet and substitute Spanish teacher. He likes this better. Even though financially he's just breaking even, he still thinks of this as a deposit toward his future.
You know, if I'm not saving for retirement at 25 right now, I'm not super worried about it. For now, it's been 100% about investing in it, in an experience, and doing something that I'll be talking about and thinking about and drawing from for the rest of my life.
In this calculus, adventure is the profit. I follow up with Cicatello by phone about how the race went.
Hello.
She came in 17th, three spots behind Underwood. Although, in her defense,
he was running just 18.
Still, Cicatello now has enough race miles to be qualified for next year's Iditarod, if she chooses to stick around. In Denali, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
So, when you were up there talking with Tara and Sean, did either of them try to put you to work?
You know, I was working pretty hard myself. I had my little shotgun microphone and my headphones and was trying to stay warm. I was trying to open doors if they were getting in and out carrying buckets of gruel, but no, for the most part.
If they did ask, could you have done it?
You know, that's a good question. I really need to check with our news director about some of the standards on assisting at that level. I'm going to have to get back to you on that.
From all the mushers and handlers you've had a chance to talk to over the past few years, do their paths to mushing track pretty closely with Tara and Sean's?
I would say they're a fairly representative sample of who I've met, you know. So take that with a grain of salt, because I didn't grow up here and I've only been covering this for a few years. But yeah, a lot of young people in their 20s who are looking for, you know, an adventure or something different, or are just trying it out for a season or two and sort of figuring it out. The opposite's true, too. And, you know, Jeff King's primary handler, Alex Buto, he's a Fairbanks boy. I mean, he's from Alaska. He grew up around dogs. So you have both. But I would say, you know, Tara and Sean in that story, they're not atypical.
Now, regardless of what path you take to get into mushing or dog handling, get the idea, it's not about the money, it's more about the experience. But does that open a door for these young people to get kind of financially taken advantage of in some way?
You know, it opens a door. That doesn't necessarily mean anyone is going through it. When I talked to Deborah Kelly, who's the director of a division at the Department of Labor, what she said was that in roughly 10 years of her memory, she remembered practically no complaints that were brought forward from people from the mushing industry, complaining of wage and hour theft or being taken advantage of, which, you know, compare that to places like restaurants or massage parlors, which are some of the frequent bad operators that the state's dealing with. And she said, you know, there was nothing abnormal about this sector in terms of people coming forward. It might be a reporting bias. It might be that people aren't coming forward. But, you know, we just don't have data points from the state's perspective saying that people are being taken advantage of.
So as far as we know, it's not really an issue.
Yes. As far as we know from the state side, it's not an issue. It's not a problem that's super closely studied.
So this story was edited and produced for radio. Were there any other interesting tidbits you had to leave on the cutting room floor?
Yes. I asked Tara at one point, what's your favorite part about mushing? What's your favorite part about handling? And, you know, I expected her to say, oh, when I'm out with the dogs on a run and I'm standing on the runners and I'm staring at, you know, Mount Denali, that's the best part. And she didn't. She said instead that when she gets to spend time with the dogs, that's her favorite thing about, you know, handling, specifically when she's doing something called bootying, which is putting on and taking off the little shoes that dogs wear to protect their paws. And she said that she has a specific song for each dog that she'll sing them while she's bootying.
Okay, so there's this one dog named Tricky Minnie. And so she's like, she reminds me actually of a little kitty cat, but I spoofed it off of Shake, 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 Shake Your Booty. So it goes. Trick, trick, trick. Trick, trick, trick. Tricky Minnie. Tricky Minnie. She loves that song.
How many songs are we talking about there?
Tara handles about 25 dogs, and she said not all the songs are that involved, but she's got a song for every dog.
It's pretty impressive. I think that's about all the time we have for this episode of the Iditapod. It's a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio. Again, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We're going to be releasing new episodes on Thursdays for the next few weeks until the race begins March 4th. Big thanks to KUAC's Molly Reddick and to Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes for joining me this week. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Next week, we'll be talking about last year's Iditarod, some of the events that transpired, and what that could mean heading into this year's race. I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
So it goes. Trick, trick, trick. Trick, trick, trick. Tricky Minnie. Tricky Minnie. She loves that song.